And, through all the fighting that took place, King John was always found, either to be eating and drinking, like a gluttonous fool, when the danger was at a distance, or to be running away, like a beaten cur, when it was near. You might suppose that when he was losing his dominions at this rate, and when his own nobles cared so little for him or his cause that they plainly refused to follow his banner out of England, he had enemies enough. But he made another enemy of the Pope, which he did in this way. The Archbishop of Canterbury dying, and the junior monks of that place wishing to get the start of the senior monks in the appointment of his successor, met together at midnight, secretly elected a certain Reginald, and sent him off to Rome to get the Pope ETM's approval. The senior monks and the king soon finding this out, and being very angry about it, the junior monks gave way, and all the monks together elected the Bishop of Norwich, who was the king ETM's favourite. The Pope, hearing the whole story, declared that neither election would do for him, and that he elected Stephen Langton. The monks submitting to the Pope, the king turned them all out bodily, and banished them as traitors. The Pope sent three bishops to the king, to threaten him with an interdict. The king told the bishops that if any interdict were laid upon his kingdom, he would tear out the eyes and cut off the noses of all the monks he could lay hold of, and send them over to Rome in that undecorated state as a present for their master. The bishops, nevertheless, soon published the interdict, and fled. After it had lasted a year, the Pope proceeded to his next step, which was excommunication. King John was declared excommunicated, with all the usual ceremonies. The king was so incensed at this, and was made so desperate by the disaffection of his barons and the hatred of his people, that it is said he even privately sent ambassadors to the Turks in Spain, offering to renounce his religion and hold his kingdom of them if they would help him. It is related that the ambassadors were admitted to the presence of the Turkish emir through long lines of Moorish guards, and that they found the emir with his eyes seriously fixed on the pages of a large book, from which he never once looked up. That they gave him a letter from the king containing his proposals, and were gravely dismissed. That presently the emir sent for one of them, and conjured him, by his faith in his religion, to say what kind of man the king of England truly was. That the ambassador, thus pressed, replied that the king of England was a false tyrant, against whom his own subjects would soon rise. And that this was quite enough for the emir. Money being, in his position, the next best thing to men, King John spared no means of getting it. He set on foot another repressing and torturing of the unhappy Jews, which was quite in his way, and invented a new punishment for one wealthy Jew of Bristol. Until such time as that Jew should produce a certain large sum of money, the king sentenced him to be imprisoned, and, every day, to have one tooth violently wrenched out of his head, beginning with the double teeth. For 7 days, the oppressed man bore the daily pain and lost the daily tooth, but, on the 8th, he paid the money. With the treasure raised in such ways, the king made an expedition into Ireland, where some English nobles had revolted. It was one of the very few places from which he did not run away, because no resistance was shown. He made another expedition into Valencia, whence he did run away in the end, but not before he had got from the Welsh people, as hostages, 27 young men of the best families, every one of whom he caused to be slain in the following year. To interdict and excommunication, the Pope now added his last sentence, deposition. He proclaimed John no longer king, absolved all his subjects from their allegiance, and sent Stephen Langton and others to the King of France to tell him that, if he would invade England, he should be forgiven all his sins, or at least, should be forgiven them by the Pope, if that would do. As there was nothing that King Philip desired more than to invade England, he collected a great army at Rouen, and a fleet of 1,700 ships to bring them over. But the English people, however bitterly they hated the king, were not a people to suffer invasion quietly. They flocked to Dover, where the English standard was, in such great numbers to enroll themselves as defenders of their native land, that there were not provisions for them, and the king could only select and retain 60,000. But, at this crisis, the Pope, who had his own reasons for objecting to either King John or King Philip being too powerful, interfered. He entrusted a legate, whose name was Bandulf, with the easy task of frightening King John. He sent him to the English camp, from France, to terrify him with exaggerations of King Philippe Thiam's power, and his own weakness in the discontent of the English barons and people. Pandulf discharged his commission so well, that King John, in a wretched panic, consented to acknowledge Stephen Langton, to resign his kingdom a to God, St. Peter, and St. Paul at Mau, which meant the Pope, and to hold it, ever afterwards, by the Pope Thiam's leave, on payment of an annual sum of money. To this shameful contract he publicly bound himself in the Church of the Knights Templars at Dover, where he laid at the legate at Thiam's feet a part of the tribute, which the legate haughtily trampled upon. But they do say, that this was merely a genteel flourish, and that he was afterwards seen to pick it up and pocket it. There was an unfortunate prophet, the name of Peter, who had greatly increased King John at Thiam's terrors by predicting that he would be unknighted, which the king supposed to signify that he would die, before the feast of the Ascension should be passed. That was the day after this humiliation, when the next morning came, and the king, who had been trembling all night, found himself alive and safe. He ordered the prophet to and his son Tuor to be dragged through the streets at the tails of horses, and then hanged, for having frightened him. As King John had now submitted, the Pope, to King Philippe Thiam's great astonishment, took him under his protection, and informed King Philip that he found he could not give him leave to invade England. The angry Philip resolved to do it without his leave, but he gained nothing and lost much, for the English, commanded by the Earl of Salisbury, went over, in 500 ships, to the French coast, before the French fleet had sailed away from it, and utterly defeated the whole. The Pope then took off his three sentences, one after another, and empowered Stephen Langton publicly to receive King John into the favour of the Church again, and to ask him to dinner. The king, who hated Langton with all his might and main, and with reason too, for he was a great and a good man, with whom such a king could have no sympathy, pretended to cry and to be very grateful. There was a little difficulty about settling how much the king should pay as a recompense to the clergy for the losses he had caused them, but the end of it was, that the superior clergy got a good deal, and the inferior clergy got little or nothing, which has also happened since King John at Thiam's time, I believe. When all these matters were arranged, the king in his triumph became more fierce, and false, and insolent to all around him than he had ever been. An alliance of sovereigns against King Philip gave him an opportunity of landing an army in France, with which he even took a town. But, on the French king Thiam's gaining a great victory, he ran away, of course, and made a truce for 5 years. And now the time approached when he was to be still further humbled, and made to feel, if he could feel anything, what a wretched creature he was. Of all men in the world, Stephen Langton seemed raised up by heaven to oppose and subdue him. When he ruthlessly burnt and destroyed the property of his own subjects, because their lords, the barons, would not serve him abroad, Stephen Langton fearlessly reproved and threatened him. When he swore to restore the laws of King Edward, or the laws of King Henry I, Stephen Langton knew his falsehood, and pursued him through all his evasions. When the barons met at the Abbey of St. Edmund at Thiam's Bury, to consider their wrongs and the King of Thiam's oppressions, Stephen Langton roused them by his fervid words to demand a solemn charter of rights and liberties from their perjured master, and to swear, one by one, on the high altar, that they would have it, or would wage war against him to the death. When the king hid himself in London from the barons, and was at last obliged to receive them, they told him roundly they would not believe him unless Stephen Langton became a surety that he would keep his word. When he took the cross to invest himself with some interest, and belong to something that was received with favour, Stephen Langton was still immovable. When he appealed to the Pope, and the Pope wrote to Stephen Langton in behalf of his new favourite, Stephen Langton was deaf, even to the Pope himself, and saw before him nothing but the welfare of England and the crimes of the English king. At Easter time, the barons assembled at Stamford, in Lincolnshire, in proud array, and, marching near to Oxford where the king was, delivered into the hands of Stephen Langton and two others, a list of grievances. And these, ATM they said, he must redress, or we will do it for ourselves. Langton told the king as much, and read the list to him, he went half mad with rage. But that did him no more good than his afterwards trying to pacify the barons with lies. They called themselves and their followers, the army of God and the Holy Church. ATM marching through the country, with the people thronging to them everywhere, except at Northampton, where they failed in an attack upon the castle, they at last triumphantly set up their banner in London itself, whither the whole land, tired of the tyrant, seemed to flock to join them. Seven knights alone, of all the knights in England, remained with the king, who, reduced to this strait, at last sent the Earl of Pembroke to the barons to say that he approved of everything, and would meet them to sign their charter when they would. A then, ATM said the barons, let the day be the 15th of June, and the place, Runnymede.ATM, on Monday, the 15th of June, 1214, the king came from Windsor Castle, and the barons came from the town of Staines, and they met on Runnymede, which is still a pleasant meadow by the Thames, where rushes grow in the clear water of the winding river, and its banks are green with grass and trees. On the side of the barons, came the general of their army, Robert Fitzwalter, and a great concourse of the nobility of England. With the king, came, in all, some 24 persons of any note, most of whom despised him, and were merely his advisers in form. On that great day, and in that great company, the king signed Magna Charta, the Great Charter of England, by which he pledged himself to maintain the church in its rights, to relieve the barons of oppressive obligations as vassals of the crown, of which the barons, in their turn, pledged themselves to relieve their vassals, the people, to respect the liberties of London and all other cities and boroughs, to protect foreign merchants who came to England, to imprison no man without a fair trial, and to sell, delay, or deny justice to none. As the barons knew his falsehood well, they further required, as their securities, that he should send out of his kingdom all his foreign troops, that for 2 months they should hold possession of the city of London, and Stephen Langton of the Tower, and that 25 of their body, chosen by themselves, should be a lawful committee to watch the keeping of the charter, and to make war upon him if he broke it. All this he was obliged to yield. He signed the charter with a smile, and, if he could have looked agreeable, would have done so, as he departed from the splendid assembly. When he got home to Windsor Castle, he was quite a madman in his helpless fury. And he broke the charter immediately afterwards. He sent abroad for foreign soldiers, and sent to the Pope for help, and plotted to take London by surprise, while the barons should be holding a great tournament at Stamford, which they had agreed to hold there as a celebration of the charter. The barons, however, found him out and put it off. Then, when the barons desired to see him and tax him with his treachery, he made numbers of appointments with them, and kept none, and shifted from place to place, and was constantly sneaking and skulking about. At last he appeared at Dover, to join his foreign soldiers, of whom numbers came into his pay, and with them he besieged and took Rochester Castle, which was occupied by knights and soldiers of the barons. He would have hanged them every one, but the leader of the foreign soldiers, fearful of what the English people might afterwards do to him, interfered to save the knights. Therefore the king was fain to satisfy his vengeance with the death of all the common men. Then, he sent the Earl of Salisbury, with one portion of his army, to ravage the eastern part of his own dominions, while he carried fire and slaughter into the northern part, torturing, plundering, killing, and inflicting every possible cruelty upon the people, and, every morning, setting a worthy example to his men by setting fire, with his own monster hands, to the house where he had slept last night. Nor was this all, for the Pope, coming to the aid of his precious friend, laid the kingdom under an interdict again, because the people took part with the barons. It did not much matter, for the people had grown so used to it now, that they had begun to think nothing about it. It occurred to Thema, perhaps to Stephen Langton too, that they could keep their churches open, and ring their bells, without the Pope ETM's permission as well as with it. So, they tried the experiment and found that it succeeded perfectly, it being now impossible to bear the country, as a wilderness of cruelty, or longer to hold any terms with such a forsworn outlaw of a king. The barons sent to Louis, son of the French monarch, to offer him the English crown, caring as little for the Pope ETM's excommunication of him if he accepted the offer, as it is possible his father may have cared for the Pope ETM's forgiveness of his sins. He landed at Sandwich, King John immediately running away from Dover, where he happened to be, and went on to London. The Scottish king, with whom many of the northern English lords had taken refuge, numbers of the foreign soldiers, numbers of the barons, and numbers of the people went over to him every day, King John, the while, continually running away in all directions. The career of Louis was checked, however, by the suspicions of the barons, founded on the dying declaration of a French lord, that when the kingdom was conquered he was sworn to banish them as traitors, and to give their estates to some of his own nobles. Rather than suffer this, some of the barons hesitated, others even went over to King John. It seemed to be the turning point of King John ETM's fortunes, for, in his savage and murderous course, he had now taken some towns and met with some successes. But, happily for England and humanity, his death was near, crossing a dangerous quicksand, called the Wash. Not very far from Wisbeach, the tide came up and nearly drowned his army. He and his soldiers escaped, but, looking back from the shore when he was safe, he saw the roaring water sweep down in a torrent, overturn the wagons, horses, and men that carried his treasure, and engulf them in a raging whirlpool from which nothing could be delivered. Cursing, and swearing, and gnawing his fingers, he went on to Swinestead Abbey, where the monks set before him quantities of pears, and peaches, and new cider, some say poison too, but there is very little reason to suppose so, of which he ate and drank in an immoderate and beastly way. All night he lay ill of a burning fever, and haunted with horrible fears. Next day, they put him in a horse litter, and carried him to Sleaford Castle, where he passed another night of pain and horror. Next day, they carried him, with greater difficulty than on the day before, to the castle of Newark upon Trent, and there, on the 18th of October, in the 49th year of his age, and the 17th of his vile reign, was an end of this miserable brute. Chapter X of England under Henry III, called, of Winchester. If any of the English barons remembered the murdered Arthur ETM's sister, Eleanor the Fair Maid of Brittany, shut up in her convent at Bristol, none among them spoke of her now, or maintained her right to the crown. The dead usurper ETM's eldest boy, Henry by name, was taken by the Earl of Pembroke, the Marshal of England, to the city of Gloucester, and the crowned in great haste when he was only 10 years old. As the crown itself had been lost with the king ETM's treasure in the raging water, and as there was no time to make another, they put a circle of plain gold upon his head instead. We have been the enemies of this child ETM's father, ATM, said Lord Pembroke, a good and true gentleman, to the few lords who were present, and he merited our ill will, but the child himself is innocent, and his youth demands our friendship and protection. ATM, those lords felt tenderly towards their little boy, remembering their own young children, and they bowed their heads, and said, long live King Henry III. ATM. Next, a great council met at Bristol, revised Magna Carta, and made Lord Pembroke regent or protector of England, as the king was too young to reign alone. The next thing to be done was to get rid of Prince Louis of France, and to win over those English barons who were still ranged under his banner. He was strong in many parts of England, and in London itself, and he held, among other places, a certain castle called the Castle of Mount Sorel, in Leicestershire. To this fortress, after some skirmishing and truce-making, Lord Pembroke laid siege. Louis dispatched an army of 600 knights and 20,000 soldiers to relieve it. Lord Pembroke, who was not strong enough for such a force, retired with all his men. the army of the French prince, which had marched there with fire and plunder, marched away with fire and plunder, and came, in a boastful swaggering manner, to Lincoln. The town submitted, but the castle in the town, held by a brave widow lady, named Nicola de Camville, whose property it was, made such a sturdy resistance, that the French count in command of the army of the French prince found it necessary to besiege this castle. While he was thus engaged, word was brought to him that Lord Pembroke, with 400 knights, 250 men with crossbows, and a stout force both of horse and foot, was marching towards him. "Eh, what care I?" "Atm," said the French count. "Ah, the Englishman is not so mad as to attack me and my great army in a walled town." "Atm, but the Englishman did it for all that, and did it not so madly but so wisely, that he decoyed the great army into the narrow, ill-paved lanes and byways of Lincoln, where its horse soldiers could not ride in any strong body, and there he made such havoc with them, that the whole force surrendered themselves prisoners, except the count, who said that he would never yield to any English traitor alive, and accordingly got killed." The end of this victory, which the English called, for a joke, the Fair of Lincoln, was the usual one in those times, so the common men were slain without any mercy, and the knights and gentlemen paid ransom and went home. The wife of Louis, the fair Blanche of Castile, dutifully equipped a fleet of 80 good ships, and sent it over from France to her husband at Tiamisade. An English fleet of 40 ships, some good and some bad, gallantly met them near the mouth of the Thames, and took or sunk 65 in one fight. This great loss put an end to the French prince at Tiamis hopes. A treaty was made at Lambeth, in virtue of which the English barons who had remained attached to his cause returned to their allegiance, and it was engaged on both sides that the prince and all his troops should retire peacefully to France. It was time to go, for war had made him so poor that he was obliged to borrow money from the citizens of London to pay his expenses home. Lord Pembroke afterwards applied himself to governing the country justly, and to healing the quarrels and disturbances that had arisen among men in the days of the bad King John. He caused Magna Carta to be still more improved, and so amended the forest laws that a peasant was no longer put to death for killing a stag in a royal forest, but was only imprisoned. It would have been well for England if it could have had so good a protector many years longer, but that was not to be. Within 3 years after the young king at Tiamis coronation, Lord Pembroke died, and you may see his tomb, at this day, in the old Temple Church in London. The protectorship was now divided. Peter de Roches, whom King John had made Bishop of Winchester, was entrusted with the care of the person of the young sovereign, and the exercise of the royal authority was confided to Earl Hubert de Burgh. These two personages had from the first no liking for each other, and soon became enemies. When the young king was declared of age, Peter de Roches, finding that Hubert increased in power and favour, retired discontentedly, and went abroad. For nearly 10 years afterwards Hubert had full sway alone, but 10 years is a long time to hold the favour of a king. This king, too, as he grew up, showed a strong resemblance to his father, in feebleness, inconsistency, and irresolution. The best that can be said of him is that he was not cruel. De Roches coming home again, after 10 years, and being a novelty, the king began to favour him and to look coldly on Hubert. Wanting money besides, and having made Hubert rich, he began to dislike Hubert. At last he was made to believe, or pretended to believe, that Hubert had misappropriated some of the royal treasure, and ordered him to furnish an account of all he had done in his administration. Besides which, the foolish charge was brought against Hubert that he had made himself the King of Tiamis' favourite by magic. Hubert, very well knowing that he could never defend himself against such nonsense, and that his old enemy must be determined on his ruin, instead of answering the charges, fled to Merton Abbey. Then the king, in a violent passion, sent for the mayor of London, and said to the mayor, "Take 20,000 citizens, and drag me Hubert de Burgh out of that abbey, and bring him here." Atm, the mayor posted off to do it, but the Archbishop of Dublin, who was a friend of Hubert at EMS, warning the king that an abbey was a sacred place, and that if he committed any violence there, he must answer for it to the church. The king changed his mind and called the mayor back, and declared that Hubert should have 4 months to prepare his defense, and should be safe and free during that time. Hubert, who relied upon the king at EMS word, though I think he was old enough to have known better, came out of Merton Abbey upon these conditions, and journeyed away to see his wife, a Scottish princess who was then at St. Edmund at EMS Bury. Almost as soon as he had departed from the sanctuary, his enemies persuaded the weak king to send out one Sir Godfrey de Cruncombe, who commanded 300 vagabonds called the Black Band, with orders to seize him. They came up with him at a little town in Essex, called Brentwood, when he was in bed. He leapt out of bed, got out of the house, fled to the church, ran up to the altar, and laid his hand upon the cross. Sir Godfrey and the Black Band, caring neither for church, altar, nor cross, dragged him forth to the church door, with their drawn swords flashing round his head, and sent for a smith to rivet a set of chains upon him. When the smith, I wish I knew his name, was brought, all dark and swarthy with the smoke of his forge, and panting with the speed he had made, and the Black Band, falling aside to show him the prisoner, cried with a loud uproar, "Ay, make the fetters heavy, make them strong." A.T.M. the smith dropped upon his knee but not to the Black Bander and said, "Ah, this is the brave Earl Hubert de Burgh, who fought at Dover Castle, and destroyed the French fleet, and has done his country much good service. You may kill me, if you like, but I will never make a chain for Earl Hubert de Burgh." A.T.M., the Black Band never blushed, or they might have blushed at this. They knocked the smith about from one to another, and swore at him, and tied the Earl on horseback, undressed as he was, and carried him off to the Tower of London. The bishops, however, were so indignant at the violation of the sanctuary of the church, that the frightened king soon ordered the Black Band to take him back again, at the same time commanding the Sheriff of Essex to prevent his escaping out of Brentwood Church. Well, the sheriff dug a deep trench all round the church, and erected a high fence, and watched the church night and day. The Black Band and their captain watched it too, like 301 black wolves. For 39 days, Hubert de Burgh remained within. At length, upon the 40th day, cold and hunger were too much for him, and he gave himself up to the Black Band, who carried him off, for the second time, to the Tower. When his trial came on, he refused to plead. But at last it was arranged that he should give up all the royal lands which had been bestowed upon him, and should be kept at the castle of Devizes, in what was called a free prison, A.T.M. in charge of 4 knights appointed by 4 lords. There, he remained almost a year, until, learning that a follower of his old enemy the bishop was made keeper of the castle, and fearing that he might be killed by treachery, he climbed the ramparts one dark night, dropped from the top of the high castle wall into the moat, and coming safely to the ground, took refuge in another church. From this place he was delivered by a party of horse dispatched to his help by some nobles, who were by this time in revolt against the king, and assembled in Wales. He was finally pardoned and restored to his estates, but he lived privately, and never more aspired to a high post in the realm, or to a high place in the King of TMS favour. And thus ended more happily than the stories of many favourites of kings of the adventures of Earl Hubert de Burgh. The nobles, who had risen in revolt, were stirred up to rebellion by the overbearing conduct of the Bishop of Winchester, who, finding that the king secretly hated the Great Charter which had been forced from his father, did his utmost to confirm him in that dislike, and in the preference he showed to foreigners over the English. Of this, and of his even publicly declaring that the barons of England were inferior to those of France, the English lords complained with such bitterness, that the king, finding them well supported by the clergy, became frightened for his throne, and sent away the bishop and all his foreign associates. On his marriage, however, with Eleanor, a French lady, the daughter of the Count of Provence, he openly favoured the foreigners again, and so many of his wifey TMS relations came over, and made such an immense family party at court, and got so many good things, and pocketed so much money, and were so high with the English whose money they pocketed, that the bolder English barons murmured openly about a clause there was in the Great Charter, which provided for the banishment of unreasonable favourites.